Right, my name's Tarek. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Tarek.
So this workshop today is going to focus on the first step. We're going to do a 50-minute session, take a 15-minute break, 50-minute session, take a 15-minute break, and then we're going to have a speaker to wrap us up. Now, in the 12 and 12, there's a line in there that says, based on a foundation and the first step, we can build happy and purposeful lives. I'm a guy that believes the first step should tell you a story of life and death. If you stare at your death in the first step, a first step, typically when I look at it, doesn't have hope in it. It has hopelessness in it. And it, my experience with powerlessness, which we're going to go into in depth, abundantly confirms to me that I have tried countless vain attempts to prove that I could control my drinking or drug use, that I could be a weekend warrior, a recreational drug user. I could smoke crack starting Thursday night or Friday night, and then I'd be done Sunday morning. I'd sleep all day Sunday and go to work on Monday. Shit never unfolded for me like that. But I had some friends that could do that, which really baffled me. And I drove after that with so much zeal that it practically drove me to the gates of insanity and almost death. And so we, Nari and I, have been taught the first step in such a way that, you know, there's so much focus on the mental obsession when you go to meetings, and we all want that mental obsession to go away. You know, the idea of taking that first blast off that crack stem was, it drove my life for many years. And when it was removed, it was a miracle. But then I discovered what the real problem was, and it was an underlying broken internal condition that I can't remedy on my own. You know, it looks like uneasiness. It looks like a sense that I'll never really be satisfied with life or my life situations, and everybody around me and every situation around me gets on my fucking nerves. Okay? You can't exist in that internal condition for very long. It's unbearable. It demands relief. It demands ease and comfort. And so another thing that I believe is that if you don't get the same ease and comfort from these 12 steps, you're going to find ease and comfort somewhere. I promise you that. Most times in early recovery, it's going to come in sex, it's going to come in money, it's going to come in jobs, it's going to come in fellowship. But that stuff's like a warm bath. It doesn't last for long. It cannot treat the real problem. And so we're going to look at it in a three-dimensional perspective. We have to. You know, a couple years ago, I went through the steps, and instead of starting at the first step, the guy that took me through the steps started me on pages 60 to 62. He asked me to look at my life and look at all the different areas in my life and ask myself, where are you living on self-propulsion? You know, my definition of self-propulsion and self-will are pretty much the same thing. I do what I want to do, when I want to do it, and I don't give a shit how it's going to affect anybody else. I'm not aware of it. That to me is the best definition of self-will and living a life of self-propulsion. Which ends up leading me to being in constant collision with someone or somebody on a daily basis. And then I end up being the producer of confusion rather than harmony, right? I'm really a self-seeker when I'm trying to be kind. All the delusions that we live under. So I looked at that first, and then I backed in to the second step. Because if we truly live a life where we bring this idea of a higher power into everything that we're doing, the decisions we're making, the relationships that we're interacting with, if we truly have that in our lives, I don't believe pages 60 to 62 show up as much. Right? So what I begin to see, the more I'm in constant collision with people in life situations and living on self-propulsion, the more there is no God in my life. My thinking mind is my only God. My sound reasoning is my God, or the illusion that I have sound reasoning. And then I find myself backing into my unmanageability, which I used to think unmanageability was going to jail, losing my home, filing bankruptcy, losing the relationships, losing the trust of my family. I thought that was unmanageable. I call that drama. It's external unmanageability, but drama has nothing to do with alcoholism and drug addiction. So shave the drama off the top, and you're left with, why do I end up in situations that are creating these things in my life? Which is the internal condition, which most of the humans on this planet suffer from, some type of broken internal condition. Except as drug addicts and alcoholics, we've discovered a solution in drugs and alcohol. And then we cross the imaginary line and we venture out into this realm where we don't have power, we don't have choice, we don't have control anymore. And for other people, they cross the imaginary line into shopping. They cross the imaginary line into sex. And, you know, they cross the imaginary line into controlling every situation in their lives. They cross the imaginary line into codependence. We just happen to cross the imaginary line into some of those things plus alcohol and drugs. So this is the drugs and alcohol are not the problem. And we're going to talk about that today by looking at the first step. First, we're going to look at it physically. And then we're going to look at it mentally, and then we're going to look at it spiritually. And Nari has created a wonderful little sheet here that can walk you through this. Look, I hope everybody in this room, this is bullshit because I know it's not true, because there's some people here who don't give a shit about sponsoring somebody else. You don't have any desire inside of you to sit down and sacrifice your Saturday morning and go to Starbucks and sit for 2.5 hours expecting nothing in return because you see a guy sitting across the table from you that is struggling and he's still in the grips of the early stages of attempting to recover, and you're there to spoon feed him the program of recovery. No, you want a Monday through Friday 9-to-5 job, and you want that just to be your life, and then you got to dabble in a couple of meetings during the week, and then you want your weekends all to yourself. Well, look, if you're going to get active in recovery, I'm telling you, that ain't the story. If you have a 9-to-5 job, and if you're in a relationship, you got a couple meetings you got to go to, and you got a couple people you got to sponsor. And if you get involved in accountability groups like Steel on Steel, they're probably going to be on the weekend. And so this way of life demands a huge commitment and a huge amount of self-sacrifice. And if you're not willing to make it and you fit the description of the addict and alcoholic in the big book, I can promise you, you're going to get high again. I can promise you, you're going to drink again. So I'm not here to sugarcoat anything for you. Those of you who know me know that about me. I'm going to tell you the truth because somebody's got to fucking tell you the truth. Fucking IOP ain't going to fucking tell you the truth. I promise you that. Somebody that tells you your life demands upon working with others. That's what I'm here to tell you. And I hope you get bit by the bug, because when you watch someone change in front of your very eyes, you will get to witness the regenerative power of God. And when you witness the regenerative power of God, it proves the existence of God. And then you become addicted to that. The much better addiction. It doesn't have the consequences that the other addiction does. So I'm going to turn it over to Nari.
Thank you, Tarek. Nari alcoholic. I'm glad you're all here, and I'm like, I could totally relate to what Tarek was saying. I came into the fellowship as a broken man, spiritually, emotionally, actually. You know, people talk about losing stuff, but I had everything. But internally, I was dying. You know. And I, every time I put down a drink, I wouldn't understand like why I'm acting like this batshit crazy, you know. And then I would go back, and then it's all after I read the big book, the doctor's opinion. It talks about that internal discomfort, the unmanageability, the sense of ease and comfort when you take the drink, and that's what takes us back into the drink. And that's one of the things like. You know, I stress upon with the newcomer. I like Tarek said, like I sit with the newcomer for 2 hours. I go to a McDonald's and I sit with this guy. I would give that 2 hours of my time so that he gets this. It's so important. That's the first step is an important step, because you need to have a correct cognition of that step. Because if you don't, and if you're thinking alcohol is the problem, what is going to happen is you're going to procrastinate. You're not going to seek the power that the big book talks about. Are you guys, you know, listening to it? If you don't get the right cognition, you're going to procrastinate. you don't need this, you know, the power. You're going to say, okay, I just go to meetings and I'm not going to, you know, work the 12 steps, and because the fellowship is going to keep me sober. But what happens is, like, 30, 40, 90 days later, what's happening is the spiritual malady is going to kick in, and people are going to hit the blind spot. The blind spot is that state of mind where you don't think about the consequences. That's the peculiar mental twist the big book talks about over and over again. Even on the working with others chapter, it talks about, you know, talk about this peculiar mental twist where the willpower is totally non-existent. Prior to taking that first drink or drug, you are not thinking of the consequences. That's what we want to drive to the newcomer. And what happens is we hit this peculiar mental blank spot, and like the Fred, the accountant story, and the car salesman, and we take that first drink. The reason is, like, it gives you that sense of ease and comfort. And then what happens is we take that first drink, and then the physical craving kicks in. So that's the connection between the unmanageability and the powerlessness. So that's what we want to highlight in this workshop, using these stories and also with some of the our experience, and also with Carl's experience. And so I'm in IT, and I love Visios, and I was thinking, like, you know, maybe I can drag some of these idea concepts and put it in a visual format. Like, you know, there is that old adage, image is worth 1,000 words, right? And so I put together this, like, so everybody has the sheet, like, you can jump to box 6.
Everybody got one of these?
Everyone?
They're over right by the front door.
Yeah, please grab one. Alrighty. So I usually start with the box 6, where we come out of a spree ending in, like, guilt, shame, and remorse, right? We are coughing the guts off in a commode, or you're in a jail cell, right? Like, and then holy shit, this shit is not working for us anymore. You come out with a firm resolution. I'm going to join a gym. I'm going to join this yoga thing, and because you're using your own willpower, right? And then what happens is, like, days go by, a week go by, a month go by, or even a year sometime. For some people. But then slowly, the spiritual malady kicks in. You know, the internal discomfort. You get restless, irritable, and discontented. And you can add, like, other stuff like anxiety, of fear. All sorts of modern adage they use, right? Like, you become bipolar, whatever, some reason. and then this thought comes up, right? Like, hey, I've been sober for 30, 40 days, or even like a year. I could have one drink, and then so you start, keying in or feeding in energy into that thought, and then that it really seems right to have a drink. You know, you justify that you got to have this drink, and then you end up taking that drink, and that's the physical craving after you take that first drink. So you got that mental part, the internal unmanageability, the mental that leads to the blind spot, and then you're looking for that effect produced by alcohol, and then you take up that first drink. And then you are caught up in this alcoholic torture. Like, it could last for a day, or a week, or a month, or even years. So I was at the Shiloh Road meeting Tuesday, a newcomer meeting. And there was this guy was talking about coming out of a treatment center, 21 years old, and he was relying on the fellowship. And he got married, and he got a couple of kids, and about 28, he's got a good business going. And what happened was, like, the the wife had taken the kids to her mother's home or something like that, and his mind said like, hey, you know what, you're a mature person now and you have a good business going, you should be able to handle a couple of drinks, right? So he had that drink and he stayed out for 8 years. And lucky, you know, we tell like people like, oh, please keep coming back, you know, oh man, you pick up that white drink, you know. Man, I feel sad for them. What if they die or hit somebody? I know a guy, I go to a correction facility at Gainesville. The guy served 7 years, got out of the prison. You know, we never saw him at the AA meeting or Sundays. But then this guy drank and was killed, got into a car wreck. In 7 hours, he was dead. So this keep coming back, you know, it works if it works, you know, it's not going to work for real alcoholics. You need to sit with these guys and tell them the true powerlessness. You know, every moment they procrastinate, it's a, you know, time closer to a drink. So that's the, you know, the vicious cycle of alcoholism and drug addiction. And I'm going to stop there and see if Tarek has something to offer there.
Thanks, Norman. You know, the other night I was at a meeting and the topic was triggers. And I really wish I had adjusted what I shared at that meeting, though, because I feel like I gave it is important not to hang out with people that are shooting dope or smoking crack or still drinking when you're in early recovery, right? It is, because I look back at my first 6 months of recovery and I completely separated myself from everyone I used to hang out with, including my family pretty much. The only time I saw my family was on family weekends, and I didn't want to spend time with them outside of that because there was just too much tension, and I just knew for whatever reason it was not in my highest good to spend time with my family. And I devoted myself to the 12-step process in recovery. With that being said, there is no such thing as a trigger. What Nari described here, this uneasiness or restlessness, the irritability, or the easily being annoyed by people and life situations, and the discontent, the sense that this can't be all there is. There's got to be more. That is the trigger. It's an internal trigger, right? And when that is going on inside of you, it's like a spring in your chest that's just tightening and tightening and tightening. And then you run across an external trigger, like a girlfriend or a boyfriend flirting with somebody, or they leave you, or the job shorts your check, or the treatment center doesn't let you go on a weekend pass, or I don't care what it is. Your mind's going to convince you that's the trigger. Right? Or walking down the aisle at the grocery store where all the alcohol is, right? There is no such thing as a trigger. You know, I was married to a woman for 5.5 years, with her for 7, drank daily, occasionally smoked pot, occasionally did cocaine, occasionally ate Molly. Did it ever trigger me? Constantly have alcohol in my house for 7 straight years. Because my internal condition is always being treated. Now, that doesn't mean my internal condition doesn't go sideways, because I'm only here to tell you that it does go sideways sometimes. But the intent behind everything is a spiritual solution. And that's one of the things we have to offer here, is a spiritual solution for our problem, which the problem is not drugs and alcohol. The problem is this internal unmanageability, which sets us up for the strange mental blank spot. You know, that's what happens to Fred, right? Fred in the book, Fred's a pimp, okay? Fred goes off to Washington to do an accounting, present some accounting evidence, and he even describes his as at the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon, and he's walking across the hotel lobby, and boom, he thinks it's a good idea to have a highball. It wasn't a bad day for him, right? There's going to come a time when you don't have a choice, right? And I love people who theorize with me, right? This was presented to me. I think you did this the other day. You know, in theory, yeah, I can go make a choice and get high right now. But in theory, I can go get a knife out of the fucking drawer and slice my wrist. Does that really mean I'm going to do it? It's just a theory. this concept of not having a choice, and Nari's going to dig into this here in a minute. So physically, what does your experience say to you? That when you start using drugs and alcohol, it produces an effect. But how many important engagements have you missed because you picked up a drink or a drug a day or so prior to it? You know, your family functions. Getting to work in a sober state of mind is an important engagement to keep. How many of us have shown up to work high or intoxicated? Right? All of us. And so I want to see loss of control. That powerlessness piece physically is all about intent. You know, for me being alcoholic, I do qualify for AA. I am an alcoholic. I drank for 17 years. I have this abnormal reaction because I looked at all the times I would go to a bar. And I was a bar. I loved going out to drink and go to the bars. And my intent when I walked in the front door of most bars was not to get shithoused, not to be visibly one of the most intoxicated people in the bar. That was never my intent. But what do you think happened 7 or 8 times out of 10? I lost the intent that I had walking into the bar, right? But for me, that would always lead to cocaine and, you know, Oxycontin and Valium and Klonopin and everything else for me that came with my experience with drugs and alcohol. What is it that sets me up to always be in that position again? You know, so we don't want to look at where the loss of control leads you. Yes, it leads to losing jobs. Yes, it leads to the DUIs and the drug arrest and being incarcerated and all those things. Yes, but why? You know, we don't want the drama to equal the addiction and alcoholism. The question, looking into your experience, answer the question why. Because I cannot control the amount once I start. I lose power, choice, and control. I lose all three. It's the triple crown, right? And we don't get it back. And I think the story of looking, when we look at our personal stories and we see the physical craving, I bet everyone in here would agree with me. It's really easy to see I cannot control what happens after I start. Does anyone have a difficult time seeing that? Okay, so your experience abundantly confirms that to you. How many people in here have a very difficult time seeing that before you put any drugs and alcohol in your body, from a state of consciousness called sobriety, that you don't have a choice? Who finds it difficult then? Interesting. I sponsor a lot of people, and it's very difficult for most of them to see that they don't have any choice. Because you know how, who in here just relapsed? Who's here is straight back from a relapse? Not you, you don't get to answer this question. You're straight back from a relapse. Do you think you chose to relapse?
Not really.
Okay. Why do you answer that way?
Because I was going to meetings every morning, talking to a sponsor every day, and I was doing more than I've ever done, and still am. I stayed out for like one day. Mm-hmm. But I just like had a migraine, I was at work, didn't have my meds, and like 3 hours of dealing with that, like when I came to feeling a little bit better, done, like all my defenses have been bypassed, and I was like, no phone calls, nothing.
All right, so the beast woke up.
No.
Yeah, okay. So, what happens if you're...
I didn't choose to relapse.
Excuse me?
I did not choose to relapse.
Okay. You want to describe your experience? I'm curious.
Yeah, I was on break at IOP, so I had all intentions of going back at IOP. My phone was off. If they had called,
that's a perfect, both are perfect.
I went back to do my relapse autopsy. I was able to see a whole lot of euphoric in the morning after a meeting, to even my sister-in-law and my best friend. I left a message. They were able to say I didn't sound right, and my best friend said in her gut something. I sounded like I'd lost all perspective an hour before.
Okay.
It started, so.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I want to share an experience. This was one of the ladies that Shiloh wrote also. She was talking about like just going to meetings, and she did this 90 and 90 and not working the steps, and slowly withdrew from the meetings. And she works in a campaign thing, so she has to travel, and she ended up in a conference, and there was this happy hour, and there was like, it was a, you know, open bar, and but she was kind of like going to white knuckle it, and she was hanging around drinking just Coke and stuff like that. And one of the ladies came and said like, hey, why don't you drink? And she said, you know, I'm taking a break. And that lady said like, are you a pussy? And this woman said like, let me show who the pussy is, right? And then she took a drink. See, that's what we're talking about. We are shut off from the sunlight of the spirit. And that's why it says like the resentment, the number one killer of the alcoholic. And my wife says like it's a killer of everybody. Sure. Everybody has like, Tarek explained, there is something going on in their life. They're going to go on a bender. So it's all resentment. It's number one disease. So what's happening is we are blocked from conscious, thinking. That's what is happening. And that's one of the main thing for me. I got to keep my spiritual malady in control. My barometer is like, am I at ease in my van? Am I honking? Am I, going after somebody? You know, that's my barometer, right? So if I'm not honking, I'm good. So I'm spiritually fit. So I don't have to worry about it. Okay. Anyways.
In early recovery, the easiest way for you to see if you're suffering from the internal condition and you're close to a drink, maybe, perhaps, or close to a drug, is defiance. Defiance. Nobody can tell you what to do. And when people in the program you're in or your sponsor tells you to do something, gives you a clear-cut direction to follow, you're defiant. And the defiance doesn't even have to come out verbally, and it doesn't have to come out in your actions, but internally you're saying, fuck off. I don't want to do that. I don't think that has anything to do with whether or not I stick a needle in my arm again. And I'm going to give you guys an example of something I used to go through with. I'd go on a 2-3 day tear, right? And the stories I share with you today are all going to try to illustrate all three aspects of this illness. The physical, the mental, and the spiritual. The unmanageability is the spiritual, broken internal condition. And so I'd go on a 2-3 day tear, and maybe I called in sick to work. I used to be an analyst for this company, and I finally show up to work, right? And maybe I passed out on a Monday. I'd stayed up all night smoking crack Sunday. Sunday morning by 5 or 6, I eat a bar, I eat a Klonopin, I hop in the shower. I take a shower, I chain smoke a bunch of cigarettes, get in my car, drive to the office, try to sneak past the receptionist so I can get to my office without making eye contact, close the door to the office, put Do Not Disturb on the phone, and stop tweaking out about 10 a.m. I can open the door to the office, I take Do Not Disturb off the phone, and I chill out, right? So I start doing some work. And then the thought begins to creep, the image of me taking a hit off that crack stem starts to creep into my mind, right? And I fight it off. No, not today, right? No, I only got X amount of dollars in the bank. I got to pay this bill and this bill. I don't get paid till Friday, and I'm not going today. About an hour goes by, and boom, the image is there again. Fucking 20 rock on a crack stem, right? It's just there, and it's working on me. And intellectually, cognitively, I'm making a choice, right? I'm choosing. I'm not going to smoke crack today. And then I get to 5 o'clock. And holy shit, I have fought the mental obsession off all day long. And then I get into the car in the parking garage. I drive out of the parking garage. And I get down. I used to work off Cobb Parkway in Circle 75. I come down the hill at Circle 75, which is where the new Braves Stadium is. And I got two options here, right? I can go straight to go home. I turn left and go 75 south down to North Avenue and Boulevard. Mm. Okay? What happens to me when I get to the bottom of the hill at the fucking red light is the intellectual sorting out process that had been available to me all day long became unavailable at the fucking traffic light. There was no choice in that moment at the traffic light. See, people, I think, have such a difficult time because I think throughout the course of the day, there is some of that intellectual sorting out process. But the big book has these three amazing, beautiful words. I'll read at the very bottom of this page, of your sheet. It's from page 24 in the big book. The fact for most alcoholics and addicts, for reasons they don't understand, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times, like that moment when I got to the traffic light on Circle 75 in Cobb Park Roy, I could not bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the bills I had to pay, or the consequences of what happened the last time, or the suffering that I endured because I was in a crack hotel for 3 or 4 days, or a crack house, and the humiliation that went along with that, and it just happened fucking 3 days ago. Not even a week or a month ago. And forgive my language. I don't know why I'm cussing so much. I'm going to try to watch it. So, one of my teachers used to say he only cusses when there's no other word in the English language to get my point across. How do you protect yourself from at certain times? How do you protect yourself from that? How do you protect yourself from the story you told me about, you know, it just out of nowhere? You know, being in a trance. You cannot protect yourself from that. Only a power greater than yourself can protect you from that. It then begs the question is, well, do I even believe in a power greater than myself? And that's another part of the journey. But making sense of this, these are the three most important words in that paragraph. At certain times, the intellectual sorting out process that the world calls making a choice is unavailable. You guys know what a true choice is, right? Option A, I examine option A. Do I want to do it? I either accept it or reject it. Deny. That's where the word denial comes from, right? And footnote, the word denial is only used one time in the big book, and it only has to do with Bill and his dad or grandfather talking about God. Do you think the authors of the big book intentionally left out the word denial and they use words like delusion, illusion, obsession, can't tell the difference between what's true and false? But the treatment industry, what do they want to tell you? They want to talk about denial. People in the rooms want to talk about denial. Our families have denial, right? Denial is the elephants in the room. Mom and dad say, no, the fucker's not in the room. We don't even know the elephant's in the room. Okay, everybody else around us sees the elephant and they reject it. We don't even know it's there. There's a huge difference in that. And that's not being able to, the best definition is not being able to tell the difference between what's true and false. So, you know, choices are examinations of options and then acceptance or rejection of those options. And so later on, we're not going to get into it today, but the big book talks about being placed in a position of neutrality later on in the book. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to be safe and protected, that the problem has been removed? We don't swear it off, nor do we avoid temptation. Right? Our whole attitude about drugs and alcohol has been changed with very little effort or thought on our part. That is one of the most magical statements and promises in our big book. I think what it means is the illusion that that thing is something I need to make a choice over is gone. So today, being in fit spiritual condition, I never have the option of drink or drug. It's just not there, guys. It's just not there. Regardless of what my external or internal world looks like, it's not there for me. I have just about as much choice today to drink as I did to not drink when I'm unfit spiritually. So what we're talking about here is we work a program of action based to treat the broken internal condition that looks like restlessness, irritability, and discontent. I mean, I'm looking out in this crowd right now, and I can sense the restlessness and irritability and discontent of half the fucking room. Are you awake to it or not? Because I am. I can feel it all the way here. Whatever you're doing just ain't cutting it. So what are you going to do?
All right, let's jump into the, you know, this material. So the material you see here is straight extracts from the big book. And what we'll do is we'll stick to this this sheet. And when we hit the stories, we'll have to switch to the big book. And so let's start with the first one, right? So this is from the working with others. This is a direct direction to the sponsors. I'm supposed to not talk about my DUIs. I'm not supposed to talk about my incarceration. I'm supposed to talk about the peculiar mental twist that leads the newcomer to the first ring. It says you got to share your story so that to illustrate that the willpower, right, it's practically non-existent. That's what we need to, you know, work on when we are working with the newcomer. So before we get into the stories, I just want to, you know, go through these key paragraphs. And I love the doctor's opinion, but I also think that the alcoholics, what happens is they tend to focus much on the phenomenon of craving pot. But this particular paragraph, which I kind of split into two, is a vital part of the disease, you know, where he talks about men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. Here is the key. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. So what it means is, like, I drink because of the effect produced by alcohol. You know, the taste doesn't matter. You know, some people get offended. You know, they think that they drink because they like the taste of alcohol. Why do you do drugs? There is no freaking taste in it. Right? You're doing it for the effect. And if you don't do it, this is the state you will be in. And that explains why every time I put down the drink, I was cranky. I was like insane. Anything my wife says, I would be like snapping at her. Can you kind of relate to it? Like my road rage was like, you know, at the peak. I would go after people, like, you know, somebody cuts me off, like I'm after them. Man, you know, I remember one woman like looking at me, where the heck are you from? I could see, she doesn't even have to say any word. I could see her face, like, you know, like Tarek was talking about this. It's like, you know, that's not me, because I'm a freaking sick person, because I didn't have booze that day. You see what I'm saying? Like, so Tarek already talked about this, the second, you know, paragraph there, you know, on page 24. This is the fact. There are some people who don't believe in this. We don't have a defense against the first drink. Left on our own resource, at times we are going to get drunk. The saying on the silver chip, I hate it. Call your sponsor before you take the first drink. I don't know who ever came up with that slogan. The guys don't understand what alcoholism is. Come up with that slogan. You guys with me? Like, the alcoholic without this awakening is going to get batshit crazy sometime, you know, in future, like if without working the steps. So finally, you know, the next paragraph, like I kind of split that doctor's opinion paragraph into two halves. Like, so you have that mental obsession creep in, and then after they succumb to the desire again, as many do, the phenomenon of craving kicks in. They pass through the several stages of a spree, emerging remorseful and a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is little hope of his recovery. So this is that vicious cycle of alcoholism. This whole 3-4 paragraphs we have illustrated in this diagram. So the big book kind of, you know, talks about the mind being the problem of the alcoholic. I kind of threw in that paragraph there. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from the drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations can be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting in the terrible cycle in motion. So here, this is a key. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body, which is the craving part. That's why I'm kind of saying, like, you know, we spend too much time in the fellowship talking about the DUIs and the number of drinks we take, you know, all the puking and all the incarcerations and whatever. But we still keep doing it. In coming, there are like all these DUI guys sitting in the corner. They already know that you're going to get a DUI when you take a drink. Then why are we talking about, like, oh, I got 9 DUIs. You know, you are like, you know, it's a competition. Like, you know, it's a trophy. I got like 4 DUIs. I got like 5, you know, incarcerations. But we did it anyways. That's the mental part. That's a peculiar mental twist. Every time we took a drink after a spree, it was that justification. We somehow convinced ourselves that we needed a drink. And I was going to a sober living house, and the guy was like, kind of said, there is no peculiar mental twist. I took a drink every time. You know, I knew. I planned it. And then I said, he literally stumped me. You know, I didn't know how to answer that guy. So I went back to the big book. It talks about like premeditative drinking. But what it talks about is like we don't look at the consequences. You see what I'm saying? We don't look at the consequences. There is a cloud. All we are focused is on taking that one or two drinks and having that effect. And then what happens is the physical craving kicks in. It's an important part of this disease, but that's not the, you know, major factor. The mind is. That's why I kind of like, you know, go back to the... So, if, end of the day, if you all can take this one thing, you know, phrase, and keep meditating on it, the peculiar mental twist, hopefully, you know, you'll get an answer. And we'll stop there.
One thing real quick.
Yeah.
So here's an example of another peculiar mental twist or a delusion. So I don't believe there's anyone that is in that fellowships that's unnecessary. I mean, if I believe God is everything, then everything that's here is part of that and it's necessary. But there's a spectrum that we all have a place on. And what happens is there are some people that come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and Heroin Anonymous, I'm going to focus there, where their progression of their illness and the extent to which they have lost the power of choice and the relationship with having to live life on a spiritual basis is not the same for everyone. You've got people that come in on this spectrum, and I think it's directly connected to the extent to which you suffer from the bedevilments on a regular basis. So you get people that come in on the spectrum here, at the very front end of it, and they can go to meetings, they can go out to fellowship after the meetings, they can dabble with some step work, they can give people the rides to meetings, and they can hold service commitments, but they never truly work the steps, they never make all their amends, they don't develop a daily prayer meditation life, and they get better. It works for them. And hallelujah, that, I mean, yes, that's awesome. It works for them. And then you've got people that are further along on the spectrum, and maybe they work the steps one time. And maybe they pray, and maybe they made the amends to the family members and a few ones that lie outside of that circle. And maybe they sponsor when it is convenient to them. And they belong here too. But the deal is somebody like me comes into the room that's a little further down the spectrum. I've completely lost power, choice, and control, and I suffer from the bedevilments on page 52 to a great degree. And then they're not trying to hurt me, but let's say I hang out with these people on a regular basis, and then I get this drill sergeant of a sponsor like me, and he's telling me to do all this stuff that these people over here don't have to do. How do you think my mind's going to start to work on me? All the people I'm hanging out with in recovery don't have to work the steps I have the way I have to. But they seem to stay clean and sober, and they're getting better. Me, because I'm delusional and I need someone to constantly look at my experience and tell me the truth, will fall victim to the belief that I can do what they do. I can go to a bunch of meetings, hang out in the fellowship, grab a service commitment, and then I get better. And I don't. I get worse. And what and the reason I'm sharing this with you, and I'm going to tell the story in the second session, is this idea about if you're a pit bull or a rabid Rottweiler for your drugs and alcohol, you know, you gotta be a pit bull and a rabid Rottweiler for recovery. But what happens is a lot of us end up hanging out with some chihuahuas, right? When we get sober, we hang out with chihuahuas. And then we want to do what the chihuahuas do. And it does not work for us. And so I, like my closest friends in here, and you know who you are, you work the steps like I do for the most part. Those are the people I keep close to me. I call them my immediate family. I don't dislike these other people, but they're my kissing cousins. Okay? That's it. I try to hang out with them, be friends with them, but when it comes down to my people and my tribe, I know who it is. And that's the whole lesson in this story, is you better get with people who have a similar experience, because then you don't fall victim to the lies as easily. That's all I'm saying. You know, we're going to take a 15-minute break.
Thank you, guys.